Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from Cowboys and Indians magazine. Killers of the Flower Moon by Heidi Brandis and Wendy Wilkinson. The new Martin Scorsese movie masterpiece lays bare a shocking chapter in American history and thrusts Oklahoma and the Osage Nation into the Hollywood spotlight. The star-studded cast, including Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, Lily Gladstone, Tantu Cardinal, Jesse Plemons, and Tenteca Means, bring to life the tragic events captured in David Grand's 2017 award-winning book about the Osage murders that gave rise to the FBI. At a small bookstore in Oklahoma City in May 2017, best-selling author David Grand spoke about a chapter of Oklahoma history I had never heard before, despite being a native of the state. His new book, Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI, had just been published. Little did I know at the time that it would thrust the state into the spotlight of Hollywood yet again. Now a major motion picture from Apple Original Films, releasing in theaters in October and later on Apple TV+, Killers of the Flower Moon tackles the true story behind a string of brutal murders of the Osage tribe in Oklahoma that came to be known as the Reign of Terror. I regretted that I hadn't encountered this bit of American history in my studies, and I was shocked as Grand led us on that journey of the Osage tribe, who, after being forced from their homelands and almost exterminated, purchased patches of rough, uninhabitable land totaling nearly 1.5 million acres in northeast Oklahoma, then part of Indian Territory. When crude oil was discovered in 1894 on that same seemingly worthless land, everything changed. By the 1920s, the Osage had become incredibly wealthy, earning royalties from oil sales throughout their head rights. Then they began to die under mysterious and violent circumstances. In the 1920s, oil royalties had made the Osage the wealthiest people per capita in the world. Then senior editor Jess Huey wrote in CNI's October 2017 issue when the book came out. But a paternalistic federal approach wrested control from the owners of mineral rights and gave it to white guardians, many of whom swindled money from their wards through various schemes, such as outrageous price markups and kickbacks. Worse, some whites would marry into the tribe, as ownership of the mineral rights could only be passed on to tribe members, and then their Osage spouses would die under suspicious circumstances. In response, the newly formed FBI investigated the murders, with former Texas Ranger Tom White leading the team, using a combination of straight-shooting frontier lawman tactics and newfangled forensics and undercover work. Officially, the body count would rise to more than 20, but Grand believes that many more Osage were murdered because of their ties to the oil money. An article called Murder and Mayhem in the Osage Hills on the official government website, FBI.gov, begins by referencing the badly decomposed body of Anna Brown, an Osage Native American, found in a remote ravine in northern Oklahoma, with what the undertaker would later describe as a bullet hole in the back of her head. One by one, at least 2 dozen people in the area inexplicably turned up dead. Not just Osage Indians, but a well-known oil man and others. when initial investigations by private detectives and other investigators were foiled or proved fruitless, the Osage Tribal Council sought federal help. Early on, all fingers pointed at William Hale, the so-called King of the Osage Hills. A local cattleman, Hale had bribed, intimidated, lied, and stolen his way to wealth and power. He grew even greedier in the late 1800s when oil was discovered on the Osage Indian Reservation. Hale's connection to Anna Brown's family was clear. His weak-willed nephew, Ernest Burkhart, was married to Anna's sister. If Anna, her mother, and two sisters died in that order, all of the head rights would pass to the nephew, and Hale would take control. The prize? $500,000 a year or more. But the FBI site goes on to explain solving the case was another matter. The locals weren't talking, and Hale had threatened or paid off many of them. The rest had grown distrustful of outsiders. Hale also planted false leads that sent FBI agents scurrying across the Southwest. Ultimately, four agents went undercover as an insurance salesman, cattle buyer, oil prospector, and herbal doctor, and eventually gained the trust of the Osage and built a case. Finally, the nephew talked. Then others confessed. The agents were able to prove that Hale ordered the murders of Anna and her family to inherit their oil rights. Cousin Roan for the insurance, and others who had threatened to expose him. In January 1929, Hale was convicted and sent to prison. His henchmen, including a hired killer and crooked lawyer, also got time. The ugly and murderous rampage not only cemented the role of the FBI as we know it today, but also exposed one of the most chilling conspiracies in American history. Even though the book telling the tragic tale has been out for 6 years, it will take the release of the film to make most Americans, and even Oklahomans, aware of the terrible true story. The heartbreaking glimpse into a dark and deadly tale of greed will also introduce a wider audience to the important story of a state that is the modern era becoming a hotspot for Hollywood movie production. Growing up in the small northeastern city of Bartlesville, I had no sense of the role my home state played in this horrific chapter of American history. Nor could I have imagined my town would become the central hub for a Martin Scorsese feature film. A critically acclaimed 3-hour, 26-minute masterpiece that received a rapturous 9-minute standing ovation when it premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in May. The movie was filmed nearly exclusively in northeast Oklahoma, with scenes shot in Bartlesville, Pawhuska, Fairfax, Gray Horse, near Osage Hills State Park, and other locations. During the production, Scorsese's Instagram account featured photos of him out in cattle pastures, scouting locations. Along with the famous director, Killers of the Flower Moon brought well-recognized actors and entertainers to the state, including Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, Lily Gladstone, Jesse Plemons, Jason Isbell, and Sturgill Simpson. Indigenous actors Tantu Cardinal, Kara Jade Myers, Jillian Dion, and Janae Collins lend their talents and perspectives to the production as well. The Oklahoma Film Plus Music Office began strategically working to recruit Killers of the Flower Moon when it was announced that Imperative Entertainment had acquired the novel's film rights in 2017. Hosting the production in Oklahoma would not have been possible without the collective efforts of state, tribal, and city leadership, as well as Oklahoma's Film Incentive Program, says Jeanette Stanton, director of the Oklahoma Film and Music Office. The production wanted to respectfully honor the origins of the true story and filmed in many of the actual communities within the Osage Nation and outlying areas where the incidents occurred, including Pawhuska, Fairfax, Bartlesville, and Tulsa, to name a few. The production was intentional in connecting with the communities in which they filmed, particularly in their direct collaboration with the Osage Nation, whose lives remain affected by the events that transpired over a century ago. Those same communities also reaped the benefits of the film. Killers of the Flower Moon was the largest motion picture to be produced in Oklahoma's history, and subsequently, the economic impact of the film, particularly on rural communities within the Osage Nation, was unprecedented. The final numbers are still being accounted for at this time, but many local businesses reported making more money during the duration of the production than they have on an annual basis. It isn't the first major Hollywood movie to be based out of Bartlesville, a city of 37,000 near the site of the first commercially productive oil well in Indian Territory. Once the hub of the oil giant Phillips 66 Petroleum Company, Bartlesville has also been deeply involved with such movies as August, Osage County, a 2013 film starring Meryl Streep, Julia Roberts, Ewan McGregor, Abigail Breslin, Benedict Cumberbatch, Juliet Lewis, and Dermot Mulroney, and written by Tracy Letts, and To the Wonder, a 2012 film written and directed by Terrence Malick and starring Ben Affleck, Olga Kurylenko, Rachel McAdams, and Javier Bardem. And for each production, they all returned to Bartlesville native and executive director of Visit Bartlesville, Maria Swindle Gus. In my role as the director of our destination marketing organization, I have served as the community liaison between any film that has been made and shot here in the area. When we had Killers of the Flower Moon, as with To the Wonder and August, Osage County, the main production office was located in Bartlesville. Most of the filming for Killers took place in Osage County and the surrounding communities, but the main soundstage was located in a refitted airport hangar at Bartlesville Municipal Airport, and most of the crew, support staff, actors, and even Scorsese himself were housed in the small town. Both Scorsese and DiCaprio rented large homes in Bartlesville. And then there were three hotels that were completely rented out for the entirety of the shoot. So it was about 500 room nights. The catering director worked with local companies. The actors and crew hung out at the local eateries and watering holes. And local businesses helped provide props, locations, and extras. While the soundstage and much of the production work was based out of Bartlesville, the actual filming of Killers of the Flower Moon was done in little communities like Fairfax and Pawhuska, where the downtowns are home to some of the still-standing historical sites. Author Graham, who spent 5 years doing research for his Killers of the Flower Moon book, is glad about the increased exposure that the film will bring. Part of the reason I told the story was that, outside of the Osage, it was kind of lost and neglected, forgotten by so many Americans. He told CNI shortly after the book's publication, "It would be so wonderful if it does become a movie that it would become part of our national conscience, which is where I think it belongs." The Reign of Terror and Getting the Wrongs Right. Behind the scenes of Killers of the Flower Moon, a lot of heartfelt and painstaking work went into ensuring authenticity and accuracy in telling the truth about the Reign of Terror. Killers of the Flower Moon has been a long time coming, and in no small part because Martin Scorsese went to great lengths to make sure his film about the Reign of Terror in Oklahoma's Osage Country during the 1910s to 1930s did justice in every way to the story, the history, and the Osage people. That meant deep preparation and consultation, from the setting and the language down to every article of clothing. In the spring of 2019, the director began to scout locations in Oklahoma on the Osage Reservation with the goal of learning the tribe's history, culture, and traditions, and incorporating the Osage perspective and their advice on getting the story right. A fan of Scorsese's work, Principal Chief Jeffrey Standing Bear was nonetheless concerned about how the story of the Reign of Terror, in which dozens of Osage who owned valuable mineral head rights for newly discovered oil-rich lands were mysteriously murdered, would be approached and how the Osage would be portrayed. A key to engaging with the community to learn their stories and to hear their concerns was an in-depth meeting between the two men. The connection was immediate. It was a great 2.5 hours, Chief Standing Bear says in the production notes of the film. I told him my concerns. I didn't want the Osage shown as just a bunch of bodies lying around. We were hoping that the history and culture would be accurately represented in his movie. Mr. Scorsese was so respectful in the way he and his people came to us. As Oklahoma Public Radio's KOSU reported, Chief Standing Bear felt reassured when Scorsese told him he saw it as a story about trust and betrayal of that trust. Standing Bear appointed people within his administration to work with the director, cast, and crew on the language, culture, and customs depicted in the film so it would be accurate. The director met with people in the community of Gray Horse near Fairfax, where many of the murders took place, and mandated that every Osage role be filled by a Native American. I take this film as an offering to the Osage people from our hearts, Scorsese told the Osage Times. Lily Gladstone, in a much lauded performance in the role of Molly Burkhart, opposite Leonardo DiCaprio as her husband Ernest Burkhart, told Variety that the Osage Nation played an enormous role in shaping the movie from Scorsese's original plan. It was very refreshing how involved the production got with the Osage Nation community, Gladstone told Variety. As the community warmed up to our presence, the more the community got involved with the film. It's a different movie than the one Scorsese walked in to make almost entirely because of what the community had to say about how long it was being made and what was being portrayed. In addition, the production team worked closely with the Oklahoma Film and Music Office and to make sure Osage artisans and craftspeople were represented in many behind-the-scenes departments and that every detail was considered and executed carefully and correctly. The efforts and collaboration paid off, not just in the lengthy standing ovation at the film's debut at the Cannes Film Festival and the universally glowing reviews, but more important in the consensus from the Osage people, whose story it is and who played an enormous role in ensuring authenticity that the movie does indeed get it right. On the official Osage Nation website, you can find the following statement about Killers of the Flower Moon. The language you hear is taught by Osage Nation language teachers. The traditional Wasashi clothing you see is made by Osage artists. The landscape is the Osage Nation reservation. We are not relics. The Osage Nation is thriving on our reservation in northeast Oklahoma, a people of strength, hope, and passion, honoring the stories of the past and building the world of a future. About Gray Horse. The Osage Indian ceremonial town of Gray Horse is located in Osage County, the former Osage Indian Reservation, near Pawhuska. The small community played a big role in the history of the era portrayed in the film and the book. The Osage are divided into the Pawhuska, Hominy, and Gray Horse districts. When Killers of the Flower Moon author David Grann visited, the Gray Horse people did not tell their story. However, when Martin Scorsese and the film crew arrived, the Gray Horse people called a meeting and spoke of their own reign of terror. That horror will be part of the 3.5-hour movie, which goes some way to commemorating the role of Gray Horse and the astounding number of people permanently resting in the Gray Horse and Fairfax cemeteries. So much to love. We talked with acclaimed chef, restaurateur, and CNI favorite Tim Love about building businesses and celebrating the holidays Western style. By Lindsay Welchel. It might surprise you to learn that acclaimed Texas chef Tim Love's first good gig in the food industry was making salads. No more surprising, though, than to learn he's now moving into fashion. It seems there's nothing he won't pursue following his entrepreneurial passions. Growing up between Texas and Tennessee and spending summers working on his father's small farm, Love surely learned about the origin of food. But he fell in love with cooking, making salads for minimum wage as a way to pay his way through school at the University of Tennessee. Cooking, to Love, was a lot like sports. As a former soccer player for a national team, he loved the competitiveness of being on the line in a fast-moving kitchen. 1 year into his first job making salads, Love had worked his way to the top and was running the kitchen. The rest had been a bit of a whirlwind as Love quickly climbed the ranks at multiple restaurants in management and as a chef, finished his degree, hiked the Appalachian Trail, met his future wife in Colorado, and finally ended up back home in Texas. Not long after settling in Fort Worth, Love decided to open his own restaurant, quite literally building much of it with his own hands, and the highly successful upscale steakhouse Lonesome Dove Western Bistro was born. Now, over 20 years later, Love has opened 19 restaurants, as well as his out-of-the-box container-built micro-resort, Hotel Otto, and fun food and music venue, Tana Hills Tavern and Music Hall, among many other successful endeavors. He's even recently added the Love Collection, a premium American-made apparel and accessories brand that calls to mind the cool confidence and rugged beauty of the Lone Star State itself. But with all his entrepreneurial energy, his heart and soul are never far from food. We sat down with Love to talk about what motivates him in business and life, how the spirit of a Western lifestyle can be felt in all his endeavors, and how he celebrates the holidays in true cowboy style. CNI, you've had a lot of success in your work, and you seem to always strive to do more. What motivates you? Tim, the creative side is really what drives me, frankly. I like to create things that most people wouldn't create. I mean, our hotel is made out of containers, which nobody had done before, and it's really cool. And our music hall is taking the hospitality side of taking care of bands to a level that nobody's ever done before. Things like that are what really drive me. I want to make the world a better place than when I came into it, and I do that through hospitality and my style of service and food and things like that. It's just a passion for making people happy, and it makes me feel really good when people are happy. So I keep looking at new ways to make that vibe and that combination of what people enjoy. When I figure out how to make people happy and give them joy, then that's what keeps me driving. CNI, whether it's your restaurants, music venue, hotel, or now even clothing, all your endeavors embrace the complete package of food, travel, style, and entertainment. Why are these everyday joys so important? Tim, I think something as simple as just sitting around the table with your kids and your loved ones and your good friends and just learning more about them is beautiful. We provide that opportunity in every way, whether it be standing next to them at a concert, sitting down having lunch, or sitting on top of the rooftop of one of our hotel rooms and enjoying breakfast. The way you get to know people is to have conversations with them, and we love to create space that does that. In fact, one of my restaurants, I don't even allow cell phones in it for that reason. I just want people to talk, and I want people to understand who they're with or who they're next to. We've lost so much interaction with all the technology that I think it's taken away some of the people's happiness. We just try to figure out ways to give them a little analog moments of great times and great days, understanding that we're still humans. You need to interact. Things get settled between people. They don't get settled over the internet. C&I. From the vibe of your restaurants and other businesses to the style of the new Love Collection, your work seems to give a nod to Texas and celebrating the Western lifestyle. What inspires you about the West? Tim. The Western lifestyle, this mythical cowboy, if you will, is like, to me, analog at its finest, right? These guys and girls go out and work the land and work the animals, and you find a lot of times when they come home, what they want to do is not watch TV, but they'd rather sit around and play cards, or read a book, or draw, or write a song on a guitar and sit outside. And that, to me, is quintessential Texas. The people that settled Texas were adventurous and pioneers and not afraid. A bit of outlaws doing things their own way, but in a respectful way. And I kind of operate my business like that. We live in a digital world, and it's very much required, but the reality of it all of us, deep in our hearts, really would prefer to sit around and hang out with our friends, break some bread and listen to a good tune, watch the sunset, or build a fire. I mean, it's 55 times better than looking at Instagram and watching TV and all that other stuff. It's fun to do, and it's heartwarming. I'm just lucky that I get to provide it. C&I, with all these adventures you've embarked upon in business, what have you learned about yourself? What has being an entrepreneur taught you? Tim, I'm the youngest of 7 kids, and we were pretty broke growing up. I would say at some point, financially, we were probably at the bottom. But the funny thing is, it wasn't really that bad. I had a great family around me. We really enjoyed each other. And so I guess that's part of the reason why I'm just not afraid to take risks, because I've already been at the bottom, and so everything is gravy for me. And I live like that. I make choices like that. If you want to do something, you've got to decide to go do it. That requires a lot, by the way, but that doesn't mean that you can't. Once you start doing something, you've got to learn that you have to have other people around you to help you. That's what makes you smart, having great people with great ideas and becoming a leader that inspires those people to continue to give you those ideas and move the ball forward. And 23 years later in my own business, that's what my position has become. I've got to be the person that inspires people to be great and teaches them how to get there. And then, at the same time, learn from them so that I can continue to do better things. Love at the holidays. We asked Western entertainment maestro Tim Love how to create a perfect ambience and the most important things to consider when throwing a holiday party for friends and family. 1. Prepare. to have fun yourself. I think when you're hosting a party, preparation is most certainly the key. I can't say it enough. When you have a party, the most important thing is to figure out a way for you to have fun also. And that's the hardest thing because you're constantly trying to make sure all your guests are having a good time. A person that's really good at throwing parties figures out a way for them to have the best time out of anybody. And the way to do that is by preparation. A well-planned and prepared meal, a well-prepared couple of cocktails that are all ready before your guests arrive, with the exception of maybe heating something up, is imperative. Growing up in Texas, we ate a lot of casseroles. You put them in the oven, pull them out, and everyone eats. But I like to prepare something a little more sophisticated than that when I can. If you're going to have anything grilled, for instance, the best way to do it is to go ahead and have everything grilled ahead of time and let it sit at room temperature. Then, when you're ready, you just flash everything in the oven for 5 minutes, especially steaks. They're really easy. Chicken is really easy. Fish is a little more complicated, but not really that much. You want to grill it to about 2/3 of what you want it to be. And when you're ready for your guests to eat, you just pop it in the oven for 5 minutes or pop it in the broiler for 2 to 3 minutes, whatever it takes. It just makes it a lot simpler. As a guy, you want to show off your grill and all these other things, but that's really not the smart thing to do. Just go ahead and take care of everything in advance. Have it ready and just heat it up. It's the same with cocktails. Everyone wants to show off the cocktails they make, but instead, make recipe cards for your guests. Put them by the pitcher of cocktails you already have made, and then when your guests arrive, add the ice. And whatever you do, have 5 times the amount of ice you think you need. Everybody runs out of ice, and it's the worst feeling on the planet. You can't make a drink if you don't have ice. Here are 2 of Tim's favorite cocktails. Gingerbread espresso, 2 ounces cold brew cinnamon vanilla, 1 ounce milk, 1 ounce Kahlua, 1 ounce chai tea infused Absolute Elix vodka. Shake and strain over ice. Garnish with a cinnamon stick. Holiday spritz, 3 ounces Aperol, 1.5 ounce cranberry juice, 2.5 ounces Mum Napa sparkling wine, 3/4 ounce Beefeater gin, splash club soda, pour over ice, garnish with bruleed cranberries and a rosemary sprig. Tim's Make-A-Wish. My greatest wish for the new year ahead is that people just work hard, mind their own business, and just be nice to each other. We do that, and lots of other great things will come from it. The American Buffalo. In his new documentary, Ken Burns delivers a superb story of resilience about the iconic giant beasts of the Great Plains. By Joe Layden. Ken Burns has gone looking for America again. The award-winning filmmaker has previously examined our shared past and our sharpest divisions in such acclaimed documentaries as The Civil War, Baseball, Country Music, The Central Park Five, and The National Parks, America's Best Idea. Now he's turned his attention to the resilient, shaggy beast that has loomed large in so many of this country's most mythic and heartbreaking tales, and given us a new 2-part, 4-hour film titled The American Buffalo. Set to premiere October 16 and 17 on PBS and remain available for streaming on PBS.com for 28 days afterward, The American Buffalo promises to take viewers on a journey through more than 10,000 years of North American history, and across some of the continent's most iconic landscapes, tracing the bison's evolution, its significance to the Great Plains, and, most important, its relationship to the indigenous peoples of North America. "It is a quintessentially American story," says Burns, "but it is also a morality tale encompassing two historically significant lessons that resonate today: how humans can damage the natural world, and also how we can work together to make choices to preserve the environment around us." The story of the American buffalo is also the story of Native nations who lived with and relied on the buffalo to survive, developing a sacred relationship that evolved over more than 10,000 years, but which was almost completely severed in fewer than 100. Burns' documentary focuses on the near extinction of bison and the near miraculous preservation of the beasts. So is The American Buffalo a cautionary tale of tragedy or an inspiring story of triumph? "I think it's the story of both," Burns responded during an exclusive CNI interview. "I mean, obviously it's a tragedy in that at the start of the 19th century, at least, we estimate that we had 30 million of the beasts. Lewis and Clark are batting them out of the way. Even in the mid-1800s, trains might have to wait for hours for a buffalo herd to pass. But then, at the end of the 1880s, nobody can find one. There may be fewer than 30 wild and free in the world. There are now collections in zoos, but the buffalo is on the brink of extinction." That's basically episode one of our two-part series. Episode two is how people, for a variety of reasons, some of them really bad, decide to rescue this animal. The American Buffalo credits Theodore Roosevelt, Charles Goodnight, and the Bronx Zoo's William T. Hornaday among the former hunters who evolved into improbable saviors. But the American Buffalo also focuses on indigenous people, such as Comanche leader Quanah Parker, who went from waging war against the U.S. Army and the hide hunters annihilating the great herds that were the Comanches' primary sustenance, to being a man of peace and living to see the bison return to his homeland. According to the PBS press notes, there are now approximately 350,000 buffalo in the United States, most of them descendants of 77 animals from five founding herds at the start of the 20th century. Better still, their numbers are increasing, thanks in large part to the central role the tribal nations have had in their return. "So we've got two acts of a three-act play," Burns told CNI. "But the third act is a big question mark. You ask the appropriate binary question, tragedy or triumph? Well, again, it is both. And now it falls down to, okay, what are we going to do now?" The American Buffalo was written by Dayton Duncan, who is also the co-author, with Burns, of the companion book Blood Memory, The Tragic Decline and Improbable Resurrection of the American Buffalo, which will be published by Knopf, timed to the PBS broadcast. Juliana Branham, Conscience Point, Native America, a member of the Quahada Band of the Comanche Nation of Oklahoma, served as consulting producer. W. Richard West, Jr., a Cheyenne and founding director and director emeritus of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of the American Indian, was the senior advisor. Voice actors in the two-part film are Adam Arkin, Tantu Cardinal, Tim Clark, Tacola Clifford, Jeff Daniels, Hope Davis, Paul Giamatti, Murphy Geyer, Michael Horse, Derek Jacoby,
Gene Jones, Carolyn McCormick, Craig Mellish,
John Proudstar, Chask Spencer, and Richard Whitman. The American Buffalo also includes interviews with leading Native American scholars, land experts, and tribal nation members, including Gerard Baker, Manda Hitatsa, George Horse Capture Jr., Anai, Rosalind Lapeer, Blackfeet of Montana and Mites, N. Scott Momade, Kiowa, Marcia Pablo, Pend Oriel and Kootenai, Ron Parker, Comanche, Dustin Tamakara, Comanche, and Jermaine White, Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. For more on the American Buffalo, go to in the in-depth conversation with filmmaker Ken Burns. Next. A new epic. Dubbed a Yellowstone origin story to remind fans that it's a way-back prequel to the bigger show on cable, 1883 might seem closer in tone and scope to A Lonesome Dove or an Into the West. The new series, which debuted in late December, is truly epic and has the creative energy and character building of Taylor Sheridan to fuel it. That's certainly a good thing for CNI readers, many of you Yellowstone fanatics who have no doubt subscribed to the Paramount Plus streaming network just to be in front and center for 1883. And if you aren't familiar with the new prequel yet, allow Paramount to fill you in a little more. It follows the Dutton family as they embark on a journey west through the Great Plains toward the last bastion of untamed America. It's a stark retelling of Western expansion and an intense study of one family fleeing poverty to seek a better future in America's promised land, Montana. Country superstars Tim McGraw and Faith Hill, the brilliant Sam Elliott, Isabel May, and LaMonica Garrett lead a large ensemble cast, also featuring the likes of Billy Bob Thornton, Martin Sinsmeyer, Audie Rick, and Mark Rissman. If you are in on the action of 1883, be sure to visit cowboysandindians.com each morning following the premiere of a new episode. There will be spirited recaps. And if you aren't watching yet, well, what's the holdup? Sam Elliott's in it, for goodness sake.
Exploring America's Outback. Adventurer and celebrated Lensman and author John Anarino guides readers through bucket list travels in a breathtaking new photography book, America's Outback, an odyssey through the Great Southwest. My passion for photography evolved from guiding students and clients on challenge discovery type wilderness journeys, hiking, climbing, and camping among the deserts, canyons, mesas, and mountains of the Great Southwest, Arizona, and Sonora, Mexico. Our memorable adventures included forays to the summits of Geronimo's Chiricahua Mountains, homelands, the legendary treasure trove of the Superstition Mountains, the sacred heights of the San Francisco Mountains' Kachina Peaks, once remote Grand Canyon indigenous-turned-prospector trails, and solo adventures on Tiburon Island in the Sea of Cortez, Mexico. Everywhere we ventured, I carried my camera dangling from my neck as at the ready. At one point, while working as a Grand Canyon boatman on the Colorado River, I think it was my 18th trip, they were all mesmerizing, I decided to move on from what someone's view as a lifelong career of you never go down the same river twice to pursue photography full-time.
but no one was looking for a shy photographer based out of a sleepy mountain hideaway outside Prescott, Arizona. I cowboyed up, as the townsfolk call it, and knocked on doors in San Francisco, New York, and Phoenix, and storyboarded photo essays I shot on self-assignments. The thematic photo essays included rough stock, behind the chutes, the toughest events in rodeo, river wranglers, whitewater rafting the forks of the Kern River with pack horse support, high-risk photography, the adventure behind the image, the name of my first photography book, charros, America's first cowboys, shot on spec during the National Charro Congress in Guanajuato, Mexico. Apache, the sacred path to womanhood. It became a book by that name. White Water Women, and other self-assignments. The first big win. One day I walked out to the mailbox and the Paris agency Gamma Liaison had mailed me a check that made me gasp. The tear sheet they included was my photo of the Eagle Tail Mountains in Arizona, plastered across a roadside billboard in Amsterdam. What? It became one of my stock photo bestsellers. I had discovered an image revenue stream and apparently an eager audience for the landscapes, people, ceremonies, traditions, and adventures I photographed in the Great Southwest. They were heady days for an Arizona photographer, going from pitching projects to haughty New York magazine editors to photography, a life assignment of an outward-bound canoe expedition down Big Bend's Rio Grande. I was just breaking into life, and I had little savings to fly into a remote airstrip near some outpost called Presidio, Texas, to photograph Fortune 500 executives tipping over their canoes, swimming and portaging rapids they'd never forget. Peering at the office walls of life, I'd studied the framed photographs of the legendary photographers that made the magazine, W. Eugene Smith, Margaret Burke, White, Gordon Parks, Larry Burroughs, Harry Benson, Dorothea Lange, and too many others to name here. Missing were the framed images I'd viewed in the offices of Sierra Club Books, Ansel Adams, Elliot Porter, Philip Hyde, and Galen Rowell. So too were the color images that hung on the walls of Arizona Highways magazine, Ray Manley, Esther Henderson, Barry Goldwater, and David Munch. I'd found my calling, though I wondered how I'd synthesize the influences in my own vision from the three publications that were giving me assignments. Missing from everyone's walls were the works of Peter Beard, Edward Curtis, John Hillers, and Timothy O'Sullivan, who also inspired me. I pivoted into photography book publishing, which I had set my sights on from the very beginning. I attended book expos in Chicago, New York, Las Vegas, and Los Angeles to meet and greet publishers and editors face to face. At an expo in New York, I'd made an appointment beforehand with Sierra Club Books publisher to pitch my photography book, Canyons of the Southwest. In a voice that sounded like the rasp of a butcher's broom, he said, "You've got 5 minutes." I handed him a sheet of 20 35mm color transparencies. Today it's a tablet or mini laptop. He held it up to the fluorescent lighting, turned to me and said, "I can sell this. Follow me." He walked me through the convention center to Random House's aisle of booths, crowded with authors, book buyers, and publishers. He gave the flimsy sheet of images to a Random House senior editor he knew. The pinstriped editor held it up to the light, and the deal was done with a handshake on the spot. That book opened the door to my career in photography book publishing. One book led to the next that spanned the great Southwest and Central America. Then I rode off into the sunset with saddlebags stuffed with royalties that were more like the washers from Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch and the gal of my dreams. So I'd thought. It didn't get easier. It was a glorious-looking but lean vocation, and it was rarely a slam dunk getting the next book greenlit. Photography books cost a fortune to publish, and the burden was, or is, on the photographer to convince a publisher that the theme, imagery, content, and market are worth their roll of the dice. After years of exploring the Great Southwest, it was plain to me that the extraordinary geography was sculpted by forces of nature that touched my soul. Volcanic mountain islands erupted high above desert seas, sometimes creating elliptical craters that resembled the surface of the moon. Thundering cataracts tumbled into flood-swollen rivers that carved deep chasms through cliffs, canyons, and sierras. Towering monuments and mysterious hoodoos, honed by wind, water, and stone-splitting, freeze-thaw erosion, resembled ancient deities like the Navajo's Haché Diné, holy people who turned to stone. Mystifying stone and otherworldly figures, etched and painted by native hands, remain hidden among wind-scoured terracotta mesas that stretched across the four corners and painted desert region from one glorious sunrise to the next. A quote from America's Outback, an odyssey through the Great Southwest. America's Outback was photographed in the American West, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, West Texas, California, Old Mexico, Baja California, Norte, Sonora, Chihuahua, Coahuila, and U.S.-Mexico borderlands. Oft times, my attempts to reach intimidating camera perches for the book necessitated climbing and bivouacking alone atop remote mountain peaks and crests to photograph sunsets and sunrises from the aerial perspective of a raptor. There was no better reward for these efforts. Many of the book's color photographs are paired with literary quotes from the Great Southwest's early travelers, authors, characters, and native peoples to illuminate the landscapes they traveled through and exemplify how their wanderings changed, inspired, and often repelled them. I'd made it my mission to go off the grid into the Southwest's unknown lands where my spirit touched down, take seldom-seen remote exposures, and photograph affable locals and their enduring traditions. I explored it by foot, raft, rope, canoe, sea kayak, seagoing panga, and, ill-advisedly, from the back of an ornery mule. I wanted to disappear into the landscape to photograph my journeys with the colors of the earth, note my perceptions, and compose evocative essays. My hope for readers is that they are reminded of a real world that exists far beyond their hypnotic cell phone screens. It's waiting to be discovered by back road or waterway, footpath, cross country, horse, or muleback. Venture beyond your horizon line. Breathe in the air. Take in the extraordinary views. The American Outback is like no place on earth. At Home with Aaron Watson. The tried and true Texas country crooner chats about both the work and play areas of his family's spread near Buffalo Gap. He's talented, smart, charismatic, and devoted to traditional country songwriting. Texas troubadour Aaron Watson remains one of the bright spots in music thanks to those traits and his latest record, last year's American Soul, runs the emotional gamut from heart-rending personal stories to celebratory cowboy anthems. He tours frequently and connects with fans online between live dates, but even the hardest-working crooner needs a place to kick back. For Watson, that's the home near Buffalo Gap, Texas, that he shares with his wife and growing children. "It feels like a West Texas resort out in the middle of the country," Watson says. "It's so peaceful out there, and the sunrises and sunsets are amazing. Being out so far from town, there's a million stars in the sky. It's relaxing to sit out around the fire pit and have some music going and hang out." Here's more from Watson on the areas in his home where he plays and works. CNI, how are your outdoor areas designed, and what were some of the key elements you wanted in them? "When we moved into the house, there was already the pool and fire pit. Over the years, we've made a few changes and really tailored it into something that is perfect for our family. We have a big horseshoe couch and a TV that adds to the outdoor living area. I just added pergolas around the pool. The evenings really are peaceful, and it's fun to go out there and watch a movie with the family. Living out in the country, we love having our own little getaway in the backyard. It's very important for me. With as much time as I spend on the road, it's nice to feel like I can have a retreat in my backyard." Now tell me about your office. What did you envision, and what did you know you had to have? "The backyard is a different story. That's something I have complete control over. The office is in the house, and I have to play by my wife Kim's rules. The office is open to the rest of the house, so it had to fit the vibe she has for it. If I'm not writing songs out on the back porch, I'm writing in the office. It was important for me to be surrounded by my guitars and musical things and memories without messing up her feng shui. What kind of decor is there, and how does it inspire you to keep working on your music, shows, and other projects?" "I have some framed show prints from playing the Grand Ole Opry and the Ryman. I also have an autographed Chris Ledoux 8x10 and an old Lone Star neon sign and my first guitar. I have things there that remind me how far I've come and how much further I want to go." What advice would you give to anyone who is setting up their own office, no matter how big or small? "Well, your office needs to be someplace where you can be productive and comfortable working. I think creating an environment where you can get the job done is the key. Hear Aaron Watson's music and find tour dates at aaronwatson.com.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.